ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Health Minister announces plans to reduce the number of people using the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Also, Donald Trump extends the ceasefire with Iran, and one of Australia's rarest birds, the night parrot, spotted at a secret location in Queensland.
It's this holy grail, and it keeps in people's minds to this day. When you mention night parrots amongst bird watchers, you always see a glint in people's eyes.
First this evening, the Federal Health Minister has announced a major overhaul of the National Disability Insurance Scheme to cut costs. In a speech to the National Press Club, Mark Butler pointed out that in the 13 years since it was introduced, spending on the NDIS has blown out by billions of dollars, and if that trend continues, the scheme won't survive. He's planning to reduce the number of participants in the scheme by 150,000 by the end of the decade. Eligibility requirements will be tightened and many participants will be moved from the NDIS onto programs run by the states and local communities. Disability advocates say they understand the urgent need to make the scheme sustainable, but they're worried by a lack of detail in the minister's announcement. David Sparks reports.
The Minister for Health and the NDIS, Mark Butler, has a blunt assessment of how the numbers are adding up.
Right now, the NDIS costs too much. And it's growing too fast, put alongside any comparable government program. And unless we take action to make it sustainable, it simply will not be there in the future for the Australians who need it most.
He says the scheme was originally intended to have around 410,000 participants, but there are now 760,000 participants. His goal is to bring that down to 600,000 by the end of the decade. The scheme is currently costing around $50 billion a year. Mark Butler wants to limit it to $55 billion by 2030, a tough ask given it's currently forecast to hit $70 billion a year by then. The measures he's announced today include tightening eligibility requirements for participants. He says assessments will be based on a person's functional capacity, a change he wants in place by 2028. He wants people who don't meet the stricter criteria to be redirected to more efficient programs run by states and territories. That would be following the example of the recently established Thriving Kids program for children with autism.
Like Thriving Kids, this will see us rebuild systems that used to be there for people with less significant support needs. Systems that were unfortunately too often dismantled, leaving the NDIS as the only port in a storm for so many Australians.
There's also a plan to slash spending on a branch of the NDIS called Social and Community Participation. That stream has seen spending grow in the space of 5 years from $4 billion a year to $12 billion a year. To help bring that down, the government will put $200 million into a new Inclusive Communities Fund to rebuild organisations that can help people with disabilities participate in their communities. People with disabilities are worried the changes announced today will result in cuts to the NDIS. Jeremy Hope is president of People with Disabilities Australia.
One of the concerning is the message was 160,000 people will lose access to the scheme if we utilise those numbers, and that's a frightening amount of number.
Another advocate, Disability Network Australia CEO Emma Bennison, is also worried what the changes will mean.
We will definitely be holding the minister to account in relation to co-design, because if the disability community is not at the table, then it's not real reform.
Professor Nicole Reinhardt is director of the Neurodevelopment Program at Monash University. She agrees that for many participants, it's time to bring back more efficient programs that were taken over by the more costly NDIS.
We need to move very quickly now to re-establish what was in the community before the NDIS 13 years ago. Because of the NDIS, the vast majority of accessibility to the community has shifted to NDIS support workers, and outside of what it used to look like, where local football clubs would naturally come together to support the disability community parents and families worked together in their communities to find a way, and there were state-funded supports and services to do that. When the NDIS started, that all shifted to a new model.
The minister also announced a plan to tighten the registration requirements for service providers and a new digital payment system to help crack down on fraud. Non-profit provider, the Endeavour Foundation, has been calling for changes along those lines for years. Its CEO is Andrew Chesterman.
Well, we've been saying for a long time, David, that the NDIS has lost its way and needed reform. And so mandatory registration, which was one of the announcements, and registration in general was an essential step to take to stop profiteering and harm. So, you know, very pleased to see some announcements around registration. We have said for some time that there is enough money in the system, but the system is too large to deal with its original intent of dealing with people with complex needs.
But, like just about everyone else, Andrew Chesterman says the minister needs to provide more detail on how it will all work. The Shadow Minister for the NDIS, Melissa McIntosh, agrees. She says the opposition supports some of the changes in theory, but it'll need more information.
The minister today was full of the message of cuts, 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 yet he had no detail on how this is going to be achieved. No detail on how he's going to reduce the mass fraud and criminal activity within the NDIS.
Minister Butler also made a major announcement today about aged care. The government will dump a controversial rule that means older Australians on support at home packages have to pay extra for help with showers, getting dressed, and continence care.
David Sparks reporting. For more on the federal government's proposed changes to the National Disability Insurance Scheme, I spoke to Kane Beckett, the Chief Executive Officer of Carers Australian Capital Territory, an NDIS participant who uses a wheelchair. He was involved in the design of the scheme and part of its first executive team. Kane Beckett, there's a lot to take in this announcement from the Health Minister. How would you explain the changes that he's announced today?
I think it's a really positive announcement, and it will bring much needed relief for people with disability and carers. It's balanced. It calls out some of the key problems that we need to address, but does it in a way which I think is reasonably sensible and I think is a good step forward.
So what changes have been announced that you think will be a relief to NDIS participants?
The scheme is $20 billion a year over budget, and even if we got rid of all the fraud in the scheme, that's not going to touch the sides in terms of the amount of overspend. So the scheme is not overspent because of fraud.
If it's not fraud, the shonky providers, and maybe children with autism blowing out the cost of the scheme, where do you see the cost savings that you want the government to act on?
It's too complex, and we're spending a lot of money on that complexity.
Can you give us an example, Kane? What's an example of that red tape?
One of the things I've been talking about today is I've just recently gone through the process of getting a wheelchair. And so despite the fact that I have been assessed multiple times by the NDIA for my particular disability, when I needed a wheelchair, I had to submit a report from an occupational therapist that cost about $1,500 that the NDIA had to pay for. And that report included evidence as to why I needed a wheelchair, even citing overseas academic journals as to why people with disabilities like me would need a wheelchair. And then when it was finally approved and I got the funding approved to buy my wheelchair, then I had to submit quotes, and then I had to buy my wheelchair, and then I had to submit a claim to the agency to reimburse me for the cost of buying my wheelchair. This is all the morass of stuff that we've put around the scheme, when actually what we should have done is just say, Kane, we know you need a wheelchair. We've got all the evidence that we need of that. Here's the money for a wheelchair. Go and sort yourself out.
The minister referred to pharmacy receipts today as well as an example of bureaucracy. Yeah. What's been going on there?
If I go to the chemist and maybe I purchase something that I need from the chemist for my particular disability, I have to submit a claim back to the agency for $5 or whatever it might be so that they can pay me that amount. The complexity of all of that and the amount of government time and energy that's spent on managing that process is a waste of time.
So how do you think that could be fixed?
More than half of the scheme is for people on less than $40,000 a year. And so if we paid those people quarterly and had digital payment systems to deal with that, they could manage their funds in the way that they needed to. That'd save the agency more than all of the fraud combined annually.
The Minister, Mark Butler, certainly made it clear that each NDIS participant is going to have less spent on their plans, going back to 2023 levels to try and save some money. Will people with a disability like yourself be worried by that news?
Yeah, I think that one for me was the most concerning just because of the lack of detail as to how they were going to do that. Social and community participation is a big bucket. Nearly everyone gets funding in that bucket. What I think the important bit there is to work out, okay, when you say you're going to cut the amount of spending in that area, who are you talking about and on what basis? Wasn't clear in the minister's announcement today. I think the devil's in the detail. I did particularly appreciate the minister calling out that the NDIS is one of Australia's greatest human rights achievements. And when we're talking about fraud, we're certainly not talking about families and people with disabilities. So, you know, I thought that was really overdue in someone calling that out. I think the announcement today was quite balanced and measured, and I think will make people a lot less anxious, with the possible exception of some of the things we've talked about where there's just not enough detail.
Kane Beckett is an NDIS participant and the CEO of Carers Australian Capital Territory. At a parliamentary inquiry in Canberra today, gas and oil companies have hit back at the environmental groups, MPs and tax experts calling for a 25% levy on Australia's gas exports. Proponents of the tax increases on fossil fuel exports gave evidence to the inquiry yesterday. Today, industry groups argued that such a move would make oil and gas companies less likely to invest in Australia. Oliver Gordon reports.
Greens leader Larissa Waters wants gas companies to pay more in tax.
The government has a choice to make. Are they seriously here to just once again deliver for the mining industry, or do they want to finally start delivering for Australians and giving us all a fair share of what is our resources?
Yesterday, on the first day of the Greens-led parliamentary inquiry into the matter, former Treasury Secretary Ken Henry told politicians to, quote, stop the crap and raise taxes on the industry. He was echoed by environment groups, think tanks and social media influencers. Today, industry was given the opportunity to respond. Queensland Resources Council Chief Executive Jeanette Hewson argued against increased taxes on resources in the middle of a global fuel crisis.
At precisely the moment when Australia should be reinforcing supply resilience and investment certainty, proposals for new gas taxes risk undermining both.
The industry representative was the first of many to draw attention to the investment that companies make in Australia and suggest any new taxation measure could scare off such activity in the future.
Companies are required to invest significant amounts of money to start up a development and importantly to continue to thrive with that development. We can't expect that money is going to just flow naturally to Queensland and I would also say to Australia. If there are clear signals that the policy stability is just not here in this country.
The idea that gas companies invest significantly in Australia and are entitled to recoup that investment was also raised by senior Shell Australia executive Cecile Wake, who told Independent Senator David Pocock how much the company had spent in Australia from 2016 to 2025.
Senator, we invested $60 billion US dollars over that period. It is not unreasonable to be able to recover that investment before you start paying a profits-based tax.
And Ms. Wake, how come you can tell me how much you invested but not how much gas you sold on that project?
Because you've asked me a very specific question on a single project and I've given you an aggregated number across all of the projects that we have. So it's
What's the aggregated number for how much Australian gas you've sold?
I don't have that number.
Again, why can you tell me how much you've invested but not how much you've sold? This seems like this tricky accounting that we hear from the gas industry where you tell us about all the investment, but you're very quiet on how much gas you're actually selling.
Calls for a flat 25% tax on gas exports have emerged as the favoured model of advocates pushing Labor to act. But increasing the amount of revenue collected by the existing petroleum resources rent tax, where the government takes a percentage of profits above a certain level, remains a potential alternative revenue-raising option. Shell senior executive Cecile Wake suggested making changes to the way gas is taxed can be unattractive to regional partners.
I think we would be portrayed as a country with significantly higher sovereign risk than we had at the time that $400 billion of investment began to be put here in 2010.
ConocoPhillips spokesperson Dr. James Matthews put forward the idea that increasing taxes could impact Australia's supply.
If there are any changes, then they shouldn't be rushed in. They should be carefully considered in the light of what they mean for investment and security of supply, and done in consultation with the industry.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese last week said existing gas contracts would not be impacted by any potential new tax. The inquiry heads to Perth this week and is set to report back before the May federal budget.
Oliver Gordon reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. Hours before the United States ceasefire with Iran was due to expire, Donald Trump has extended the pause in hostilities. There had been no signs the Iranians were going to show up for peace talks in Pakistan. In a social media post, the US president said he'd pushed out the truce deadline at the behest of Pakistan, taking into account the fact that, in his words, the government of Iran is seriously fractured. The US is maintaining its blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, a move that Iran says violates the ceasefire terms. Our reporter Barbara Miller has the latest for us. Barb, tell us a bit more about this social media post from Donald Trump announcing he was extending the ceasefire and what it means for the peace process.
That's all very unclear at the moment. Donald Trump says that he is extending the ceasefire. This was initially a two-week ceasefire until negotiations conclude. Now, negotiations, of course, haven't even started, a second round at least. He says he's doing this because the Iranian government is fractured, and essentially he's leaving them time to come up with a unified proposal. Now, it's unclear here whether Iran is essentially calling Donald Trump's bluff. They have not committed to a second round of talks. And that's left the vice president, J.D. Vance, in an unenviable position of having been about to depart for Islamabad for a second round of talks, and now having to say that he has changed his plans. The official line from the White House was because of further policy meetings. So unclear when and if this second round of talks will take place.
And Barb, what are we hearing from the Iranian side?
We're not hearing anything official so far in response to that, but what we've been hearing from Tehran over the past few days is that they have no concrete plans to attend a second round of talks. And it's that sense again that perhaps their timeline is not quite as pressing as the US's in this, and that they perhaps can allow themselves a bit more time than Donald Trump can to decide on what terms and if to attend any second round of talks.
If the talks were to go ahead, what are the main sticking points likely to be?
Well, the Strait of Hormuz is the most pressing issue. I think both Iran and the US and indeed the rest of the world want that key shipping lane open as soon as possible. Iran may try and impose an ongoing toll system there and may ask for other concessions if it agrees not to do that, perhaps some sanctions relief, perhaps the unfreezing of assets. And then the potentially much more difficult problem is what to do about Iran's enriched uranium and nuclear ambitions. And all those issues are going to take a very long time to tease out. So I think perhaps a realistic goal might be to try and get some kind of agreement if the talks go ahead on the Strait of Hormuz, and an agreement to keep talking on the nuclear issue.
The American statements on the war have been erratic, to say the least, and we know the war is unpopular at home. How much of a problem do you think it's going to be for Donald Trump domestically if the war does drag on?
I think it's a significant problem, a growing problem. We've had poll after poll, including from Pew Research, from Reuters, ISPOS, suggesting that approval for the president's handling of Iran is in the 30s. Now, that's about as low as his dismal approval ratings. So all that with the midterms looming in November. Now, that may seem like a long time away, but the rising fuel costs are a major concern for Americans. Donald Trump came to power promising to address cost of living pressures. He also came to power promising not to get America embroiled in any more foreign wars. Both those issues are a real problem for him, and the party could be in significant trouble if he can't get a handle on that soon.
Barbara Miller reporting for us there. A new population of one of Australia's rarest birds, the night parrot, has been discovered in Queensland. The critically endangered bird is found in one other location in that state and in small pockets of WA, the Northern Territory and South Australia. As Connor Byrne reports for Birdwatchers, this new sighting is one of the most exciting discoveries in decades.
That's the bird call that made conservationist Steve Murphy sit bolt upright one morning earlier this year.
Well, it was about 3 a.m. in the morning and I just was going through some of the validation work, and there it was, and I listened to it over and over and over again, and we checked with a colleague and we were pretty excited.
He's been chasing the elusive night parrot in the Queensland bush for decades. It's estimated that only a few hundred of the tiny birds remain. Steve Murphy's not-for-profit group, Conservation Partners, placed 120 tiny recorders in thick Spinifex grass in the bush, which captured the equivalent of 20 years of continuous audio. It was a big effort and it paid off.
Equal parts luck and equal parts detective work, I think. I mean, we went out there with a pretty good understanding of what night parrots need in terms of habitat requirements, but there is a lot of country out there.
While he's heard the calls repeatedly, he's never actually seen a night parrot at this site, which is being kept secret. But relying on sound and not sight to identify the night parrot is reliable, according to the University of Queensland's James Watson.
You don't have to see them to confirm they're there. The best way to confirm they're there is to hear their calls, and they call pretty loudly about half an hour after dusk and half an hour before dawn.
Dr. Watson said fewer than 20 scientists and birdwatchers are believed to have ever seen a night parrot.
It's, you know, this holy grail, and it keeps in people's minds to this day. When you mention night parrots amongst birdwatchers, you always see a glint in people's eyes.
There's already a known population of them in Pullen Nature Reserve in southwest Queensland, but these birds are about 150 kilometres away in another location, also kept secret. Dr. Murphy says that's far enough away to be a separate, crucial population. Sean Dooley from BirdLife Australia, who is yet to see a night parrot, says the critically endangered bird symbolises the resilience of Australia's outback ecology.
It's become this mystical phantom bird of the outback. The fact that it comes out at night and in the day it's hidden in these dense, spiky spinifex tunnels. People have essentially gone mad looking for this bird over the last 100 years. And I think it's every birdwatcher's dream to find a night parrot. And while the entire birdwatching community is going to be exultant about another discovery of a further population, there'll probably be just a little hint of jealousy in every birdwatcher's heart, because we'd all like to see a night parrot for ourselves.
Aside from feral pests, scientists say changing fire regimes, driven by farming and climate change, pose a serious threat to the spinifex the birds depend on. Dr. Murphy wants to return to the secret site as soon as possible to take advantage of recent heavy rain in southwest Queensland, which he says encourages breeding. He says increased calls might help pinpoint the population's precise roosting and nesting locations.
From the parrot's perspective, what we need to do is really refine our understanding of where they're occurring. Like, we're in the right neighbourhood, but we really need to pin them down. And then once we do that, we can start rolling out some really serious feral cat control work to secure the remaining birds that are there.
Dr. Murphy says confirmation of the new population could be significant for the survival of the entire species and remove the need to artificially create a second backup population of night parrots to protect their future.
Connor Byrne reporting from Queensland. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on ABC Listen. And that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning too. Rachel Mealy will be bringing you PM for the next week or so. I'll speak to you again soon. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump went into the war with Iran thinking it would be over quickly. Now, more than 7 weeks later, with a ceasefire about to end, there's still no obvious off-ramp. Today, a former Iran negotiator in the Trump administration, Nate Swanson, on what the US president needs to do to end the war. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.